Artistic with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi and welcome to the 86th episode of Robots. I'm Jana and this is the final of our three-part series on robot art, compiled by David Saint-Dong. Today we will be hearing from Lionel Mora and Ken Rinaldo, engineers and artists who are working on fascinating projects around autonomous and biological robots. But first, as always, is the news with Christine.
Thank you. The Canadian robot Dexter, which is part of the mobile servicing system on the International Space Station, ISS, and operational since February this year, has been successfully used to replace a faulty circuit breaker on the outside of the space station. Up to now, swapping the circuit boxes needed to be done by astronauts during spacewalks. The use of the robot now allows ground-based flight controllers to perform routine tasks like this replacement while the crew sleeps, saving time for science and research instead of maintenance spacewalks. It also makes work much safer by avoiding the risks of a spacewalk to perform the same work. This latest success in a time of serious budget crunch in the US is now leading to renewed calls for more robotic telepresence as a potential cost saver in space exploration. A video of two chatbots talking to each other has gone viral on YouTube with more than a million views in its first few days online. Usually, chatbots converse with humans and try to convince them that they, as well, are a human rather than a computer program. In the video, the two robots start by exchanging some pleasantries, but then quickly get into an argument about whether they themselves are robots, until one of them claims to be a unicorn, upon which much bickering over logic and religion ensues. The chatbots will now compete in the 2011 Loebner Prize competition in artificial intelligence, and if any of the entrant program manages to fool two or more judges into thinking that they are a human, the program will win $25,000. To learn more about the ISS robot Dexter and to see the chatbot video, have a look at www.robotspodcast.com.
Lionel Mora is an independent artist from Lisbon, Portugal. As a European ambassador for creativity, Mora promotes the idea of making art that makes art, and was the first in the world to build a robotorium, which is a zoo for autonomous robots. He talked to David about the idea that the future artist might be a robot.
Hi, Lionel.
Hello.
Welcome to Robot Podcast. To start, maybe you could tell us how you start to work with robots in your artistic creations.
Yes, I've always been what you call a conceptual artist. That means that I work more with ideas than with my hands. Mm-hmm. So I've used in the 80s, and mainly in the 80s, I've used work a lot with photo-based work. But after, in the 90s, I've turned more to science and to try to learn from science and to be inspired by science in order to produce a new kind of artworks. So art is evolving all the time. Art is something mm-hmm. that is not finished. There is not an end. It's a long history, and this history is changing every day almost. So I think the role of an artist today, like at least in the last centuries, is to open doors for creativity, is to work, to explore new ideas, is more that than to do paintings or sculptures. So I've become very much interested with artificial intelligence in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And then very quick, I've jumped to robotics because being an artist, I intend to work in the physical world and not just in the virtual world. Mm-hmm. So robotics was a good solution for me. And also perhaps a difference with the artists that work with machines and robots even, is that my intention from the beginning was not to have the robots to do what I want, but to have robots to do what they want. That means that they have certain autonomy, they have certain intelligence, and a certain creativity, because we are talking about artworks.
Yeah, you're having a different approach in robotic art than many other artists that I know. We'll talk a little bit later about at least the last manifesto you did in Istanbul. If we look back at the beginning of your works, you were telling us that in the beginning of the 90s you start working on artificial intelligence. Could you describe us one of the works you've done at that time?
Yeah, in the beginning, in the first, my first experiments were very much related with forms, and trying to have some algorithms to generate original forms, 3D forms, and that could be applied not so much to sculpture, because in that time I didn't think so much in that direction, but really more to architecture. Very quick, this was very problematic because architecture has a lot of things that must be in place, must be a door, a stairs, a window. So it was not so good to explore the autonomy of this kind of intelligence, and much less of the robot. So that's why very quick I jumped from trying to create forms in the computer to have robots to do drawings and paintings. That's what they do in these last 10 years. I've created my first original painting. My first original painting done by a robot was made in 2001. And it has really opened a completely new door of exploration for me.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe us a little bit about how the robots you're having right now, the robots painter you're having right now, how they work, technically speaking?
It was very important and very decisive that in the 90s, I've learned about a new kind of algorithm that appeared by then and that today is very common, and it was called the ANT algorithm. And this ANT algorithm simulated the behavior of ants. So as you know, ants make trails based on pheromone deposition. And when I've seen these trails in the computer, these virtual artificial trails, mm-hmm. I thought, why not to transform this in a drawing? So that's why I've started experimenting with this new kind of algorithms, new in that time. Today they are not. But and then I've done this first in the computer, as I've said, and then I've jumped to robotics. And so my robots, most of them, especially the first ones, they are like small artificial ants. They work together, they work as a swarm, they work together, and together they build a composition based on the deposition not of pheromone, but of color. So they can recognize color and they react to color collectively, and that's the process to make a painting.
So basically each of those robots are equipped with different different colors so that he can draw, and at the same time different detectors so that he can track the colors on which they're rolling.
Basically, a robot is a computer with eyes and legs, so that can walk around, and that has some sensors to detect something. In this case, my robots detect color. So, and then there is a brain, which is a computer, and they do everything on their own because they are autonomous. So sensors are very important because of one aspect is that with sensors, these robots, they gather new information. So because many people think you make the algorithm, so all the orders and all the behaviors are in the algorithm, and that's not true, because of course I put some information in the algorithm or in the brain of the robot, but when he's able to gather new information, basically with the sensors, this adds to the complexity of the, let's say, the thinking of the robot and the decisions that they make. So that's why they do original things and not just make always the same painting.
It's some kind of behavior emerging from from their collaboration.
Based on emergence and based on cooperation when they are a swarm. Or also, I've now the more recent robots, they are not a swarm, they are alone, they do alone their things. But let's say that the swarm is in the brain. It's not a collective group of robots, but each robot has a kind of swarm, let's say, inside its brain.
How many of those robots have you built?
Many, because I've started with, as I told, with collective robots. So I did a lot, and then I've experimented with different kinds of robots, different kind of abilities to sense color, different kind of movements. A lot of small changes that are kind of evolution, like a natural evolution. Here is a kind of artificial evolution that each robot that we make, it's a step forward in the robot evolution.
Interesting. As you were saying in the beginning, you're working a lot on the theory of art and on conceptual artworks. One of your last performance, which was held in Istanbul, was a manifesto for robotic art or art made by robots. Could you give us a word about the content and the context?
Let's say that in this kind of work, in the kind of work that I do, there are two artists. I'm an artist, and the robot is also an artist. So the robot, as an artist, makes some works that we can call art. Me, as an artist, what I intend is to do basically two things. First, to open the door for a thing that we could call artificial creativity, because I believe that if we accept that there is something called artificial intelligence, then it's natural that from that intelligence we can also make an artificial creativity, because it's a normal, let's say, derivation of it. The other aspect is that if we accept these works as art, then we are opening the door to the possibility of accepting a non-human art. That means some art that is not made directly by humans, but is made by machines, robots, and also animals, because if you open this door, you open to everything. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very much interested in this non-human art. My manifesto in Istanbul was exactly a manifesto to promote, let's say, this idea of the possibility of a non-human art. I think it's very important because this excessive anthropocentric view that the human is in the center and everything is made for the humans is catastrophic. I believe it's much more interesting that we understand that we are not the only ones, that we live in a planet with many, many life forms, a universe with many, many life forms that we don't know, we have never seen, but they exist, that is for sure. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that we humans should evolve to a more, much more broad view of things, and not always be thinking that everything is made by for the humans. And is, I give an example that is very banal, very interesting, being banal also. People tend to think that flowers, which have these beautiful colors, they are beautiful for women. But in fact, flowers are very beautiful for insects, to attract insects. They don't care nothing about us. And so there is many things, many life forms, including machines, that they don't care so much about us, but they do their things. And their things are very interesting for us. So that's what I try to achieve with my artwork.
Mm-hmm. And so you were saying, by giving the example of the flowers are interesting for some kind of insect, what would be the purpose or the interest for a robot to make art?
Of course, in this moment, the art made by robots are just questioning our concept of art. That's their task, is to question our own ideas, what we think is art, what is not art, the authorship, that's important, who is the artist, it's me, it's the robot, and so on. So let's say that that these robots are playing a bit the role of a Dadaist or of a surrealist who have raised many questions about what is art, what is not art, and so on. So that's what they do. Being a bit visionary, I believe that these works will be a kind of the primitive art of some species that is now evolving in our planet, and in the future the clever robots will like very much this artwork. I'm sure I will not be alive. If I was, I could sell very well these paintings to the robots, very, very clever robots. But I think there will be a kind of mark in the history of robotics as one of their first artistic expression.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting forecast. So if I'm going toward our next subject, I'm wondering if you had to go through collaboration with scientists or engineer, being in private firms or in university context, to develop these artworks or to inspire you to create these.
Yeah, of course. Making the kind of art that I do is a cooperative process. I could not do this without the help and the interaction with the scientists and engineers. It's clear. Anyway, as I've told, from the 90s, I've get much more close to scientists than to other artists that I didn't Yeah, I didn't follow so much the kind of discussions of the mainstream art. Doesn't interest me. So I've turned to scientists and engineers. And so I've learned a lot with them, and some of them also have learned a few things with me, because this is really a very interactive process. Because I don't just take a technology and do something with it. What I do is, when I look at a technology, I see how I can change it in a certain way. And to change the technology, I need the help and the cooperation of scientists that understand what I want and that they think it's possible, and that they also, in that process, they also discover new things. I can tell you that my first paintings, robot paintings, were very much appreciated by scientists of special of artificial intelligence. One of my first paintings, or one of my robots, have come to be the cover of the Artificial Life magazine of MIT, because they understood that I did something that it was very, very interesting for them, because in that time, they have never tried this kind of algorithms in robots. They were working on a computer. So they have never tried it in the physical world. Now there is a lot of scientists working with that, with a swarm of robots and so. But in that time, I was the first. And so that's what I, this is a two-way interaction. I learn a lot with them, and they also learn a few things with me. And so we were able in the last years to develop some projects together, beneficial for both.
Could you give us an example of one of these collaborations and how you create this link with either this engineer, scientist group or individuals, how you contact them and how you went through the process of both creativity and production of the robot?
Well, as I've told, I know many scientists.
Just an example.
I participate a lot in scientific conferences. Mm-hmm. In fact, actually, in the first years of my work with robots, I went mostly to scientific conferences. Now it's becoming also art, the art world, but it's still a bit close to this new art. But in the beginning was just scientific conferences. So I know a lot of people. And also the other thing is, for example, talking about the robots. I don't buy robots already made. I made them from scratch. So that means that we need to work very close. I need to see who is able to do that, a certain kind of robot that I want. And then we work very close because we need to make things sometimes that were never done before, because this is a completely new field. So it's always a very interesting cooperative process.
You were saying that you learn in these collaboration as well as they learn from you in these collaboration. Could you give example of such influence?
I can give you an example, as I've told. When I've learned about this ANT algorithm, I've looked at it, I've tried it in the computer. And so I've done a lot of experiments with this algorithm. But I've seen that it could go further, and I could apply it to a machine in the beginning, or than a robot, and that I've done on my own. So the scientists that have teach me and talk about this new algorithm, it just opened a door for me, and then I've used it as an artist, and I've changed the algorithm in order to be able to apply it to a machine and to robot.
and it opened new perspective of application and understanding of this algorithm for scientists working on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. One of these scientists, very important, he has one of the paintings of one of my robots in his office. So.
So it led me to the last part of our interview, which is a really popular question, of course, but a really fundamental one for robotists and I guess for artists that are working in robotics field. On your point of view, what is a good definition? What is a robot, or what should a robot be?
Let me first say something. Mm-hmm. The creation of robots, special in recent times, was based on, let's say, an inversion of what have happened with nature. Because we have created first the mind and only after the body. And this is very problematic, as we know. Because as we know, in nature, the body was created first and then developed a mind.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, robots have, most of the problems that come out of robots, they derive from the way they were born. So first with a big brain, a very intelligent mind, but without body, and then with a very, very primitive body. I see robots as a new species, very much as a new species, an artificial species, but as we have dogs, cats, and robots. I don't see a big difference. And as a species, it will evolve. Of course, in this moment, still, the evolution is based on our own attempts to make them more clever, more better, more efficient, and so on. But at a certain point, they will evolve on their own, and there will be big changes, of course. As I've told, I see robots as a new species, artificial species, but a new species.
Really interesting, Lionel. Thank you for giving us some of your precious time to share with us your knowledge on robotic and your experiences. It was a pleasure for us to hear from you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Ken Rinaldo is director of the Art and Technology Program in the Department of Art at Ohio State University in Columbus. His work focuses on the integration of organic and electromechanical elements. An example of his work is the Living Robotic Tongue Installation, which is a large robotic tongue controlled by an artificial stomach filled with living bacteria.
Welcome, Professor Rinaldo.
Yes, thank you, David. It's lovely to be here with you.
Thank you. Professor Rinaldo, to start our discussion, I would like you to explain the reason and the circumstances how you get to use robots in your artworks.
Well, I think for me as an artist, many of my artworks started out as static works. And I'll always remember that when I was a graduate student studying in the Conceptual and Information Arts program, at San Francisco State, that during a critique, one of the students asked me why my works only implied movement and didn't have actual movement. So all those years ago, that began my first experiments with kinetics to make something move. Once things started to move in a kinetic way, I got bored with repetitive motion that required the mastery of electronics eventually and robotics to start to introduce ideas of chaos and artificial life and unpredictability, if you will, in the behaviors of the robots. So, but that really was the beginning of my excitement with electronics and motion and interaction and interactivity.
One of the specificity of your artworks, well, of many of your artworks, is that the electronics and the mechanism in your robot or in your interactive installation are always used in an aesthetic way. So yeah. We see the electronic, we see the mechanism, and it's on purpose that you're dealing with them so that it's part of the aestheticism of the whole sculpture.
Yes. Yeah, I'm really interested in the beauty of electronics, the sheer beauty of even something as simple as like a resistor or a microchip. You're looking at, for me, what's a cultural monument to the highest essence and expression of the greatest brains on the planet. And, you know, when I see an integrated chip, even the awareness of how an integrated chip is made, you realize you're seeing manufacturing and, you know, at its top. So that for me is very exciting. And I often look in natural systems. I look for models of what technological systems can become. So in a lot of my works, I try to draw formal and structural relationships between natural systems and technological systems. You'll notice, for example, a lot of tree structures in my work because I'm interested in branching structures and neural structures, vascular systems. Natural systems, as they express themselves, represent beautiful and exquisite models for technological systems.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of mixing natural structure with technology, could you give us a word about the concept behind one of your early work, Delicate Balance? I think there was tree branches in the project, as well as fishes.
Yes. Yeah, with Delicate Balance, I was really, in a way, I was sort of asking a conceptual question. And I guess the question was, if a fish could control a robot, would it make the choice to do so? And could I create an environment that would, in a sense, be sensitive enough to the consciousness of the fish that would allow it to make that choice and make it somewhat pleasant for the fish? So what I found was a series of Siamese fighting fish in a glass of water. And my thought was, how could I design something that would make it more interesting for the fish? And I thought, oh, of course, a robot vehicle. But what I decided to do was make one balance on a tight wire, which is a convenient way to get power into the robot. Mm-hmm. I basically made a brake beam system out of infrared and allowed the robot to swim through the brake beam and move the robot to one side of the wire. If it got to one side, it found a mirror that it was able to look at itself in. And with male Siamese fighting fish, they see a mirror as an opposing male, which gets them very excited and interested. So basically, this guy would find his way to the mirror and kind of look at himself all day, competing with his own image. Mm-hmm. So that was the work, Delicate Balance. But the title, I think, also made allusions to ideas about ecology and degradation of ecological systems. I'm quite concerned with sustainability and so on. And so some of those issues creep into my work, strangely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're always involving a lot of nature in your work, or even at some point some bio-inspired mechanism. I'm thinking about the spider butt, the articulation of the spider butt were, if I'm not wrong, bio-inspired, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Explain us a little bit the mechanism of the spider butt.
And you're absolutely right. And for me, even though I had been exploring some of the kind of mechanisms that you describe, which are basically pull string mechanic mechanisms that I've been able to fashion and to evolve to some extent. But the joints of the spider robots were really roughly based on looking at the way a finger joint works and trying to minimize the number of motors necessary to drive a robotic foot to some extent. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, surrounding ideas of, that was maybe just the physical structure, but the idea of the work overall was to try to find a robot that would be able to discover its own food source and arise into a kind of energy autonomy, not unlike the way ants do when they forage in their environment and bring food back. And as a collective, I was interested in seeing if that could exist as a group of autonomous robots behaviorally, and if that behavior, in a sense, would emerge from all of the randomness that existed in the environment. So I was using and thinking about ideas of consciousness and what is consciousness, and thinking about how so much of our intelligence, as with ants, is not in our brain. The environment structures how we move forward. Of course, it structures how robots move forward too. But with ants, of course, they lay down a pheromonal trail, which becomes a kind of a memory for them, you know, a memory of where the food is, at least a memory that lasts for a while and then degrades in the weather. And so I was sort of interested in exploring some of those ideas as well in relationship to artworks and robotics and installation and interaction and so on.
Mm-hmm. When you're speaking about emergent behavior with the spider bots, were they communicating with each other? Were they reactive to the audience?
Yes, they were. They were reactive to an audience in that they could see the audience with ultrasonic, I call them eyes, but of course they're ears. They looked like little eyes. Mm-hmm. But they could also see each other and respond to each other. So the position of one, for example, with its infrared would determine the position of the other because their legs could easily become entangled. I had to create a kind of an infrared apron around all of them to keep them equidistant from each other. Then they were given kinds of behaviors of the ability to, you know, also localize on a beacon. In this installation, we built 10 of these robots, and they were able to localize on a beacon and find and move toward it, but it's not something that we implemented in the final exhibition in England where these works premiered. Even though they could talk with each other with Bluetooth, as it turned out, Bluetooth was so consumptive of power mm-hmm. that my batteries were running so low so quickly that I disabled that during the exhibition to allow the robots just to move for a longer period of time and interact with people, which is what they were also designed to do. So that was, you know, how that project manifested. Recently, though, I did get to work or display the Megaliere in Switzerland. I did a series of new pieces for them recently, but also got to re-engineer the works and worked with some students from École Polytechnique de Lausanne, EPFL, and with some other wonderful companies in Switzerland that contributed some very wonderful new motors for the projects as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're getting to my second subject. I was wondering how you're building your robots. I mean, from what I understand in our last meetings, you're building a lot of those parts by yourself. But are you using some collaboration with engineers or researcher in university or from the industry to help you to build those complex robots?
Well, you know, in a sense, I feel that in a techno-augmented world like ours, when we utilize engineered material, in a sense, I see this as a kind of collaboration. It's a cultural collaboration broadly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I take a microchip, in a sense, I feel like I'm taking the knowledge, the sort of collective structural knowledge that exists in that object and utilizing it in an expressive way. But it's a higher order product in a way. It's a reprogrammable microcontroller is a kind of, you know, it's like a reprogrammable brush. I could think of instead of making a brush stroke, I can make a behavior with this mm-hmm. thing. So I often engineer my own works. You know, I do the electronics, the board design, the 3D modeling, the laser cutting, the manufacture of them. And often I will also hire, you know, people to help actually laser cut the works. I have some laser cutting facilities at Ohio State University, rapid prototyping, et cetera. But when it comes to production, I'll have to often sub that work out. On the other hand, I've also had great benefits of collaborating and have had, you know, a wonderful ongoing collaboration with my wife, Amy Youngs, for example, in our farm Fountain, which is a project that's ongoing. And I think at this point we have five of them in existence. And one of them is a solar-powered aquaponic farm in basically that we built at a hotel that's completely solar-powered. Another one is a system that we built in our home basically that allows us to eat tilapia and fish that we're growing or have grown in the tank and fresh vegetables. I've also had the benefit of most recently working with some current graduate students on a project that I'm going to be premiering at Nuit Blanche in Toronto. And this is a new robotic series called Face Music, commissioned from Nuit Blanche. Shirley Maydell was the curator. And basically this project will track your body heat, move toward your face. When it captures your face, your face will be digitized, and those values will then be seeds toward auto-generative sounds or songs. And the symphony of six of these robots will basically, or all these robots together will conduct a symphony responding to people's faces. So the project is called Face Music. Mm-hmm. And that's the current example of a project I'm working on. But
really interesting. If I'm getting that, for example, I'm curious about how you made the conception of the spider bots. So the mechanism of the spider bots that are quite bio-inspired, as you explained us earlier. Yeah. Did you make research on that on your own side to understand the physiognomy of this mechanism in the human body, or did you contact some biologist or
no
about that? So you did that on your own
and
try to reproduce it by your own?
That was an example of a project that really, before I started the spider robots, I really didn't know how to 3D model. So that was a project where I had to learn to 3D model. But I basically had a lot of sketches that I was able to slowly transfer into 3D models and pull them and morph them and make them into new forms. And also worked at that point with a graduate student who did some early sort of prototypes or visuals, I guess you could say, of what the robots would look like. But then from there kind of took over the modeling and had to, in a sense, move the conception of what I thought could work physically through the process of trying to realize it physically. One thing is virtualized and it looks like it could work, but you and I both know, as all engineers know, that it's an empirical question. Until we actually try it, we can't confirm its functionality. And in this case, I had to go through at least four or five physical iterations to confirm the functionality of the leg. Once I got one leg to work, I was able to confirm six legs working, and then it became more an issue of control and sensor feedback and so on.
And you programmed also everything in the SpiderBot yourself?
No, the spider robots basically were programmed by my collaborator, and basically he did most of the programming directly, but some of the programming was also done by me, but most of the programming was done by him in basic code. And that was a man named Matt Howard. Basically, Matt was one of my former, strangely, Matt studied robotics and electronics with me, and he really didn't know, truthfully, anything about electronics or robotics, or very little. But when Matt came and took my class, he was actually a very good programmer already, although not programming in basic code, he was programming in C. He very quickly mastered that programming, and so when years later I got the commission and was invited to, come to England to present the piece, I sort of scanned my community and I thought, oh, Matt would be a fun guy to collaborate with. Let's see if he's interested. Sometimes I have excruciatingly quick turnarounds on projects, so I try to bring people in. Sometimes things are a little bit more relaxed. For example, this last year I got to make a new work that was a robotic tongue. And this was the project that was commissioned by Maison Dallier. This tongue was a robotic chair.
Beautiful project, yeah.
Oh, thank you. So it gives you a massage based on, the health of some bacteria in an artificial stomach. And, this is an example of a project that, involved programming microcontrollers, but it wasn't, and hacking into a robotic chair controller to sort of repurpose it and recovering it and restructuring a robotic chair. I didn't, in a sense, build all the robotic mechanisms from scratch. I sort of more repurposed it. So sometimes, as with the paparazzi bots, I'll engineer something from scratch, motors, microprocessors. In this case, paparazzi bots was an example of a work that was completely, built and programmed by myself. But other times I'll take and repurpose things that obviously are beautifully and exquisitely engineered, like the chair I was able to repurpose for the enteric consciousness work, that give you a massage. So,
in your creation process, I hear a difference with many other artists in robotic art that I've been working or speaking to. It looks like your process is closer or a little bit closer to the traditional engineering process. So in your conception, and then you're doing the conception, and then you're studying the mechanism that you want to do, and then you're doing the 3D modeling of it, the iteration, the virtual iterations, and then building it. So do you see a difference between more material driven process or standard engineering process? What are the differences you think in speaking of creations?
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent question, and I think it's a really great question in a sense. Like, if I look at maybe the epitome of contemporary manufacturing, maybe epitomized by a company like Apple, you know, with amazing designers, of course, there's economies of scale and materiality that have to exist there to make them feasible to produce and be successful. But what I love about being an artist is I get to play and do and work with any materials I want. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'm really excited with and about is the nature of materials, both engineering materials from the standpoint of making artworks that display behavior as an aesthetic, but also to think about what I would call the language of materials. Like, how does hair, for example, in a sculpture make you feel? Or how does a stone make you feel? Or how does a living fish, you know, that's soft and delicate, how does it make you, what's the emotional space of that? So I am interested in this kind of juxtaposition often between the natural and the biological and the mechanical and the electronic and kind of bringing all these worlds together and asking questions about what those relationships are. Are there structural relationships? Are there things we can learn both ways? Are there lessons that we can apply, you know, maybe both ways? But often when I conceive of a project and think about it, I feel that, you know, as with many of my colleagues in robotics, I start with a concept, and then what I do is I look for everything surrounding that concept that I can find, and every relationship and every sort of conceptual connection. Like face music, for example, will be covered. These six sculptures will be covered with hair, human hair. Mm-hmm. And this piece really speaks to the kind of hybridity, the state of being a hybrid that we all exist in, where we're both human, but we're also robotic. You know, you and I, the fact that we're talking, you know, intercontinentally and having a conversation as if we're across the room from each other is a perfect example of, you know, again, of this technology augmenting us and allowing us, you know, new ways of thinking and speaking and being and so on. So often when I conceive of these projects, I guess I'm also looking at technology as material, but also, you know, what it says and how it feels for us and how it gives us new possibilities of, expression around the realms of behavior as well.
Which I think is a new perception for engineering that could help us understand the new ways of perceiving the material we're using, but also using different material for a different purpose that think of. My last question.
Yeah.
It's an open question, actually. I'm just asking you on your own perception, on your own from your own philosophy, what is a robot, or if you prefer, what should be a robot?
Yes. Well, what I see is, I believe we're headed to a new symbiosis with machines. And this excites me and it scares me. But the kind of things that I like to think about when I think about the future of robotics is how these machines will come to allow us to have extended reach and extended sense, as our conversation is now. But I also like to think about how we'll feed them, how they'll survive in our environments, what they may provide us, what they won't provide for us, and so on. So I often think that we're going to have some form of new augmented reality. It's probably going to be through heads-up displays. And my feeling is that more so we will have, you know, robots that will be able to assume avatar-like effects at a distance, but they'll most likely be rolling robots and things of that nature, you know, rolling into work or having a worker bot at the work maybe might be more common. But, I think that there's we're going to have to start thinking about new ways of powering them. And maybe a human waste stream, for example, might be the perfect way of powering a robot in the future. Maybe that will allow new forms of symbiosis between humans and their intelligent machines. But I think it's an exciting future. It's also a scary future because maybe the best example of this augmented reality that I could think of today is often put out there by our military-industrial complex, and it's the increasing use of drones for war-making and war-fighting. And this, for me personally, as a pacifist, is a scary future, one that I wish to oppose. My robots and many of the robots I think within the realm of the arts are intentionally peaceful things, meant to, by design, to explore ideas that surround creativity, kindness, gentleness, gentle relations between biological things and machinic things, which are emerging into proto-living things, which we see now. And, the question is will we go into that future fighting these new proto-living things, these robots, or will we go into that future having them as assistants, as, ways of augmenting what and how we know the world? And will we go into that future, with them as partners rather than as, objects and elements of fighting and war and destruction? I'm hoping for the creativity side of things and the arts side and the engineering and the arts continuing to collaborate in positive ways.
Mm-hmm. Do you think at some extent robots can be creative? It's maybe a tricky question. There's many definitions involved in that, but...
Absolutely, yeah. We've already seen artificial life success with recreating many patents. We've had also emergent behaviors, and I think occurring in robots, we see, robots certainly already having gotten over issues of, being able to walk around their environments and somewhat intelligently navigate. But I think if we can think about marrying an expert system, with a walking robot, in a sense, we have a semi-emergent intelligent being at that point. And I think we're rapidly headed there, perhaps not as rapidly as some of my colleagues believe. I think we're quite a few years off from robots that are just moving around our general streets and environment and navigating. But I think it, hopefully within our lifetime, Dave.
Okay, well, thank you, Professor Rinaldo, for your precious time and for your great answer to this question. I'll let you go back to your robots for your next exhibition in Toronto at the end of the month.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Okay, thank you, David, for your time. Good talking with you. Bye-bye.
And that concludes our special series on robot art. If you feel inspired to find out more, go to our website at www.robotspodcast.com. The next episode will air in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. Be Artistic with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.